I'm Hannah Young, and you're listening to The Caring Economy with Toby Usnick, sponsored by Philanthropic Impact.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Ladies and gentlemen, wherever you are in the world, welcome back to The Caring Economy with me, Toby Usnick. Today I have as my guest Steve Hasker. You can't talk more globally than Steve and his world because he is the President and Chief Executive Officer and Director of Thomson Reuters as of March 2020. Steve leads a company of over 25,000 employees who operate in more than 75 countries around the world, providing its customers with critical news, information, and technology. The company's products primarily serve professionals in the legal, tax, corporate, and media markets. Previously, Steve served as a senior advisor for TPG Capital, a private equity firm, and chief executive officer of CAA Global, a TPG Capital portfolio company, and global president and chief operating officer of Nielsen, an information and data measurement firm, which we all know in the media space. He spent more than a decade with McKinsey as a partner in the global media, information, and technology practice. And before joining McKinsey, Steve worked in several financial roles in the United States, Russia, and Australia. He started his career with PwC, where he qualified as a chartered accountant. He's a non-executive director of Appen Limited, and a member of the Australia and New Zealand Institute of Chartered Accountants. He received his MBA and master's degree in international affairs from my alma mater, Columbia University. Steve Hasker, welcome to The Caring Economy.
Thanks, Toby. Great to be here. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, so we already can tell by my readout of your background, but also your accent, that you're not from here, so to speak, meaning New York. So tell us a little bit about you, where you were born, raised, and your upbringing, and how you found your career trajectory.
Yeah, sure, Toby. I'd love to. So I grew up in Australia. My mother was a social worker and had a psychology degree, and my father was an engineer who went on to run a number of different public companies in Australia. I studied at the University of Melbourne. I started, as you said, at Pricewaterhouse, and that was really when I was an athlete. I was a track and field athlete, and Pricewaterhouse had a partnership that was particularly accommodating to aspiring athletes. I did that for 4 years. I then went to Columbia, which I loved, our alma mater. I was there for 3 years, did an MBA and an international affairs master's before joining McKinsey for 12 years. And I did all manner of work at McKinsey, based in Australia, based in New York for most of it, but ended up being the sort of partner who tended to travel the most and do the work, whether it was in media or information services technology, all over the world. Toward the end of my sort of 11th year, it's hard to believe I was there for that long. I loved every minute of it. But Dave Calhoun, who'd been at GE for 27 years and had been attracted across from GE to do a turnaround and public listing of eventual public listing of Nielsen, approached me and said, "Look, I think you should join. Most of your consultants think you know how to run businesses, but most consultants don't. I'm going to teach you. I'll give you an apprenticeship in how to run a business." And I thought that was an offer too good to refuse. So I joined Dave. I was there for 8 years or thereabouts. And then the TPG folks, particularly Jim Coulter, came knocking and offered me the opportunity to join CAA, which I did for a couple of years before ending my time with TPG as an advisor there. And then I got a call about Thomson Reuters. I've been here for almost 3.5 years, and notwithstanding COVID, loved every minute of it.
But take us back to the sports piece. That's really, you kind of skipped over that quickly, no pun intended. But what was your sport within track and field, and how did that sort of motivate you in your career?
I was a hurdler. I was a 400 meter hurdler and a 110 meter hurdler. And I inherited that from my father, who'd been a very successful hurdler in his youth, and my elder sister, who was a very talented athlete. So it was sort of a bit of a family calling. I got into it. I loved it. I lived and breathed it for many, many years at high school and college, and then for about 4 or 5 years after college. And I think, you know, for those of you who've competed in track and field, the words that come to mind is nowhere to hide. You know, you're essentially sort of on your own on the track, and you're either fit and ready to go and you're ready to perform, or you're not. And that for me was a great sort of life lesson, was that, the sort of the heat of competition, the nerves that brings, handling defeat and failure when you really think you're ready to do something special and you end up flopping. And also, you know, when things go well, being gracious about that. And so I loved every minute of it, but it was, there were lots of lessons learned along the way, and they weren't always easy or fun ones.
Yeah, I'm laughing. I did track and field, but not as well as you in high school. And when you say nowhere to hide, I'm reminded that also I think there's a place for everyone in track and field, there right? You can be fast, you can be a pole vaulter, you can be long run distance. It's really quite amazing how diverse it is, gender inclusive. I mean, it really is a place for everybody, don't you think?
It sure is. It's a very pure sort of form of sport and athletic. You know, you're running or you're jumping or you're throwing or and obviously it requires a lot of speed and strength and skill depending on your discipline. But yeah, it's not as popular now as it used to be. You know, when I was coming up, particularly in high school and the early days of college, the big track meets in Australia used to get pretty good crowds on a Thursday night. Whereas now I think, you know, sort of talented young athletes go to the conventional pro sports. You know, the opportunities are bigger and broader, and I don't blame them for doing that, but that landscape has changed.
Yeah. Oh, so when you came to Colombia, was that your first time out of Australia?
I visited the US a couple of times before, and one of those trips was actually to scope out a few graduate schools, and I ended up sort of falling in love with New York and both the business school and the international affairs school at Columbia, and ended up there. And as I said, I loved it. Didn't have a bad day at Columbia. I had got exposure to at least three Nobel Prize winners while I was studying there, which was, you know, an extraordinary for a kid from Australia. Was an extraordinary privilege.
Truly, yeah, and the history and the legacy the school offers. I was there for graduate school and financed my degree working in Lewis and Hall as an administrator of the Reed Hall program, the junior year study abroad program. And Michael Sovereign was then president. I'm not sure what years you were there. But it's been fascinating now to watch all these years since with Lee Bollinger, who's now about to term out after 20 some years and has done a phenomenal job.
Hasn't he?
And now we have an incoming woman of color who's a Brit who's going to be running the university. So it's quite impressive, I think, in how it just goes from strength to strength.
Yeah, I agree.
So, and I'm sure they're knocking on your door regularly for some checks. So tell me a little bit about McKinsey World. What I really want to ask you about that, and you can decide if you want to answer, is now I'm seeing a lot of ChatGPT debate about how it's doing what a McKinsey consultant could have done over weeks or months in a matter of seconds. And I don't know if that's fair at all. It's probably a bit dismissive, but do you keep up with folks at McKinsey? And how was that chapter for you?
I do. We actually had something of a reunion for the New York media practice a couple of weeks ago. It was terrific to see everyone. So yes, I do keep in contact with many of those I worked with. For me, it was an extraordinary place to be. And I think, you know, the fact that I was there probably longer than most, 11 or 12 years is a long time to be in consulting. It's a long time to be traveling most weeks, moving from project to project. But the level of talent that I was able to interact with, and the sort of diversity of work, you know, different clients in different parts of the world, in different industries, different problems. I think in a lot of ways it brought out the best in me. You know, I think some of the things I was involved with were, you know, I had no right to be involved in at the time, given my sort of skill and knowledge set. So I suppose smart enough to work hard and listen.
Particularly for younger professionals starting out, opportunities at agencies and service organizations where you do get a portfolio, what I would call a Whitman sampler, if you know those chocolate boxes.
Yeah, sure.
It's a great way to kind of suss out what feels right for you. But I wonder, did you also then start to date? Did you marry at that time, or did you put your personal life kind of on hold, or get an airplane?
It would depend. It depend on who you'd ask. I didn't get married. I did date, although it is very challenging. You know, I found myself at one point I commuted from New York to Lisbon for about 5 months. So every Sunday night I was getting on Air Portugal and flying across to Lisbon. And this was in the days before sort of fully reclining seats. So, you know, the seat would sort of go back about that far on the overnight flight on Sunday night. It's a very challenging thing to do. And some, you know, manage it well. I would say I was okay at managing that, you know, but just the sheer energy it takes to sort of get yourself into a different city, into the mindset, into a very intense problem-solving environment, and then to sort of parachute back into your personal life. I can really sympathize with those who can only do it for a short period of time.
Yeah. And that's before you even look at the body clock and time changes, right? Right,
exactly. Although the one thing it's worth noting, I was there between the age of 28 and 39. I don't know that I could do it now at age 53. I think it would be much, much harder.
I hear you. And now then you go on to CAA, you're talking about talent, right? This is like top of the heap in terms of global talent management. How did that happen? That was a bit of a segue, no?
Yeah, well, Jim Coulter, who was is one of the founders of TPG, and I think not only a titan of private equity, but an executive and a financier who truly cares about the world and cares about people. You know, he and his partners had invested in CAA back, I think, in 2013 or 14. And so by the time they approached me, what they were looking to do was to diversify the sort of talent agency side of the business into related industries, whether they were in technology or entertainment in the broader media landscape. And so that was really the sort of the reason I went there. And the more people at CAA I met, the more I liked them, the more I respected sort of the way they went about it and the values that the purpose-driven values that they applied to their work, which is not always associated with Hollywood or talent agents, but I think the way they do it is different. Not long after I joined, though, the writer's strike held. So the Writers Guild started to basically got in a pretty contentious set of conversations with the agents and the agency industry more broadly about diversification of agency activities. And that meant that I think rightly we at CAA pulled back from that diversification challenge. So we got a few things done in terms of building up a data asset and acquiring a couple of different businesses, but they were very much centered on the core agency side of things versus that which I was more familiar with, data, technology, the broader advertising-driven media landscape.
Yeah. And you must have a sense of deja vu now then with the writer strike here again. And again, the writers, I think, as I understand it, looking for more financial reward for their efforts, particularly with streaming services and the like. But it's another variation on having their content, their creations going in different ways and whether or not they get compensated. Is that a fair assessment, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a long way from the current dispute, current set of conversations. So this is very much an outside-in perspective. But what I would say is there's a similarity. And, you know, what was happening when I was at CAA, or what had happened, was that a number of the agencies had diversified into different areas and invested in studio assets, done more and more of what's known as packaging, which is sort of putting together all the pieces of IP associated with a television program. And you know, that had caused some disquiet amongst the writers. And I think similarly, you know, we're in a world now that's very, very different in terms of streaming. And the economics of streaming programs are very different than the old broadcast or cable TV models. And again, I think that that's really the genesis of the disquiet amongst the writers and the reason that they're asking for these conversations to take on a different tone and tenor.
Yeah, agreed. You know, I spent a good amount of time at the New York Times and we were dealing with digital, which I want to ask you more about, particularly with Nielsen. And we had a Supreme Court case, the Ticini case, that went all the way up to the Supreme Court about how the archival data was to be shared and if they were to be remunerated for it. And in the end, the writers won. But that seems almost like Internet 1 or 2.0 now compared to all the different things that are affecting the way news and content and information is spread. I wonder if you might share a little bit about the Nielsen years in particular, but also, like, it seems to me you have a unique perspective, a 30,000-foot perspective, as well as the trenches of digital data in news and media through the past 25 years. You were there, like, on the playing field, right? So what are sort of your broad swath takeaways about what has happened to media and digitization and maybe the good, the bad, and the ugly?
Yeah, I mean, it's been an extraordinary 25-year period. I mean, I remember being at McKinsey when we all went out for an internet conference in Menlo Park, and everyone wanted to do everything related to the internet, and it was a new thing. And then, of course, there was the dot-com bust. And then by the time I went to Nielsen, what was happening at that point was companies like Yahoo were experiencing really solid, mid-teen, early 20s growth in users and advertising revenues. And they were doing a wonderful job of sort of turning that into a very viable business. And then along came mobile and along came social. And these were seismic shifts. And they were shifts that companies like Facebook and Google were able to take full advantage of, both in terms of the Facebook at that point site and then application, and the same with the Google search algorithm and the Android operating system and so forth. And with those tech shifts, entirely new business models are created, and old ones or not so old ones are disrupted. And so from the Nielsen vantage point, we took an approach very early on that we were going to measure viewership no matter where it occurred and no matter what the supporting business model was. And so sort of making that decision, in a sense, was the easy part. The hard part was then designing the mousetrap to do that. And we were actually able to do that with the help of Sheryl Sandberg and Brad Smallwood and the folks at Facebook, because they gave us access to the Facebook registration data. So anonymized access to age and gender and zip code data that was really was akin to sort of taking a Nielsen panel and just blowing it up to hundreds, if not millions, of times the size globally. And so that was a huge breakthrough in terms of the product set. Then the next step was, of course, when you're the currency, which Nielsen is for or has been for many, many years for television, you can't unilaterally say, you know what, we've designed a different new product, here it is, and just throw the data into the marketplace. You have to get the buyers and sellers of advertising and the buyers of sellers of a subscription-based content model to, in a sense, opt in. And that's the hard part, because any new metric involves winners and losers. And so there'll always be an entrenched interest that says this isn't the right thing to do. And
Wow.
I think to this day those conversations are ongoing.
Yeah.
So I'd be very disingenuous to declare victory during my time there. I think we made some real steps forward and some innovations, but in terms of getting the buyers and sellers together to create a new currency, that's a much harder thing to do.
Yeah, I mean that also is the kind of change that requires education and patience and empathetic listening, because just because you present it and say ta-da doesn't mean they're going to want to get it, right? They might want to put their heads in. With Sheryl Sandberg, was it in? I presume that they were doing Facebook was happy to do that because it was in their interest to be measured in a sense, to put them in the same sort of advertising competitive set as broadcast, print, traditional media, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because in 2010, when these conversations were sort of started, Facebook was a relative minnow in the advertising space, and she and her colleagues were clever enough to figure out we need to be refereed by the most credible referee on the field, and that's Nielsen. And so, with that in mind, she said, "Okay, how can we help? And how can we help you do this in a way that will be credited by the Media Ratings Council, and therefore will be sort of has a better chance of being accepted by the different proponents?"
Ladies and gentlemen, again today on the Caring Economy, I'm really honored to have Steve Hasker. He is the president and CEO of Thomson Reuters, the global news organization. Steve, let's talk a little bit about the Thomson Reuters years now. I'm a news junkie. I worked, as you know, at the New York Times, and I'm a big believer in the journalism and the creators and the truth of it all. I wonder, first of all, how did you get there? I mean, there was a recruiter involved and stuff, but psychologically, what was it that kind of caught your imagination?
Yeah, I mean, in both my McKinsey years and my Nielsen years, I had been a student of Thomson Reuters. So I'd sort of looked across the fence, and it was a publicly listed company, and looked at what TR was doing in the business information services landscape, in the news landscape, within legal, within tax and accounting, within corporate risk. And I admired the company and the assets within the portfolio. So when I got a call in late 2019, early 2020, would I be interested? I leapt at the opportunity. to have a conversation with the TR board and see whether it was for me.
And it's proven to be for you, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a, as I said, it's a tremendous set of assets, firstly. And secondly, the culture that's been at Thomson Reuters for many years, well before I was here, is a very caring culture. It's a highly intellectually driven culture. So we have 25,000 people, the vast majority of whom have advanced degrees, are extraordinarily smart. And you couple that with a culture that for decades, for generations, has been one of caring. If you step into one of our offices, people will take an interest in you. You know, whether you're a customer, whether you're a new colleague, whether you're a visitor, it just has that sort of, you know, family orientation. And both of those things, the quality of the portfolio, the sort of intellectually driven nature of the company and this caring culture, those things together made it a very attractive place for me to join.
Yeah, that's been my observation. Both, as you said earlier, ever since I worked in media relations, Thomson Reuters has been at the top of the heap in terms, certainly as a wire service, but even just as a news organization. Right. More recently, like I'm working with Joan Soley, who runs videography here in New York, and she's just that kind of collegial professional person. But then when I go, for example, to the Bureau in Washington, I see what you've described, right? You're welcomed in and you move around and you'll see the TV studio, radio, and people will take a genuine interest in you. They'll make the time. The other thing that I really like about Thomson Reuters, other news organizations have it as well, but I really feel that perhaps you're a little bit more nimble and smaller and therefore it feels more present, is just the global experience of the average employee. These are people who have been there for long terms typically, and they've rotated, not by force, not by anything but curiosity and professional growth. That's my take on it. I wonder if that's a fair take.
No, I think it is a fair take, and it sort of spans both the professional side of the business, which is the larger side of business. So this is serving content-driven technology to lawyers, to tax and accounting professionals, to risk professionals, government agencies, and so forth. And then the news bureau. We're the largest, in a sense, wholesaler of news in the world. And the thing that's common across that is what we call the trust principles. So in the throes of the Second World War, the Reuters board was approached by at least one government with a view to here's how the story should be told. And the Reuters board sort of, I think, very wisely took a step back and said, okay, we need to create a set of principles, and we'll call them the trust principles, and they're going to govern our activities from henceforth in terms of being fact-based, telling both sides of a story, completely unbiased journalism and reporting. And what when the Thomson Company bought Reuters in 2008, the Thomson Reuters board adopted the trust principles. So they've really, in a sense, been pervasive across the company in the way we behave with customers and with colleagues and the communities in which we operate since that time. And it's a very powerful set of principles that we talk about constantly and we do our very best to live by.
Yeah, I wonder how the rubber meets the road. I think about, you know, this week it's been CNN and the whole town hall with Trump, and you know, all news organizations are engaging with the White House and with Beijing. I wonder how you guys seem to do it in a quieter way that just gets on with the business of journalism without a lot of, I don't know. It just strikes me as you're just sort of under the radar in a certain sense of the spectacle of it all and really just getting the story out.
Well, I think part of it is, as I said, the trust principles. They are our sort of guiding light. And they dictate that we don't take sides, that we do triple check the facts, and that we really be the source of information. And I think the other part is that supports this is our business model. We are a wholesaler of news to the London Stock Exchange Group, as our largest customer, to all of our agency customers, which are many of the media properties that each of us consume every day. And because we have that, the support of those sort of clients and constituents, it means we can be the source of news and we can be, you know, unbiased, unopinionated, fact-based in a way that perhaps the sort of direct-to-consumer facing news outlets have a harder time being.
Yeah. Perhaps it's even a higher compliment to say you not only have the support, but you have the expectation of how Thomson Reuters is going to deliver consistently, right?
Exactly.
You can only, with truth, journalism is built on truth. And if you cross that line, you just can't come back. I wonder if you could talk a little bit then about purpose, both in your career, but also at Thomson Reuters. The principles suggest this, and you've mentioned it earlier. Purpose-driven leaders, again, here we might sound woke to some audiences, but it's my advice and my reading, in my writing and my books, my podcast, is to really help individuals think about their own purpose and higher purpose and how they tie that in with a brand that they want to associate their career with. And I wonder if you could just wax a little bit on that.
Yeah, I don't think it's related to the sort of popular narrative around woke or not woke or anything like that. It's as simple as this. When we sort of stepped back during the pandemic and asked ourselves a simple question: why do we do what we do? Why are we all working so hard for Thomson Reuters, and more importantly for our customers? And we came to a pretty simple conclusion, which is we do what we do to inform the way forward. That's the sort of tagline we use. But what that really means is we help customers uphold the rule of law and provide access to justice. We help customers create functioning taxation systems, which I know doesn't sound very sexy, but it's incredibly important to the foundations of society. We help customers in the form of law enforcement catch bad actors. We help we support journalists to report the news where it's difficult and dangerous to do so. When you step back from those three or four things, we think they're really good for the world and good for society. We are lucky and very privileged insofar as, as a group of 25,000 professionals, when we come to work in the morning, we are doing work that we think helps humanity and helps the communities in which we operate versus some other more complicated, perhaps selfish set of objectives. And it's interesting, Toby, we've stated this, and many of our customers are attracted to that and it resonates with them. Not all, but most say, okay, that makes a difference as I think about a purchasing decision that helps. And equally importantly, when we've gone out to get young talent, particularly software and engineering and digital talent, it is increasingly important to them. I think when you and I started our careers, it was certainly in my case, it was about getting a job, not getting fired, and putting in a day's work and hoping that, it led to another day's work. I think young people today do ask themselves the question, what is the purpose of what I'm doing, much more actively than I used to. And they want to make sure that they're spending their time and their energy and their talents towards something that is improving, the community and the society in which they live. And so we've had a fantastic success rate in attracting young talent, particularly technology talent, to Thomson Reuters in a way that's been surprising even to me, and I think is a real competitive advantage.
I would agree. That's been my observation. I also think that there's something I've only ever worked for companies that are, well, except for one tech company, which was part of the dot-com explosion, Razorfish. I've only worked for companies that are 150 years or older. So,
Right.
and now with Her Majesty, His Majesty's government, it's, 1,000 years old. So, I think though that younger people are actually kind of drawn to more established brands, not just the shiny new ones, because there's a track record, there's provenance, there's legacy there that is all verified, searchable, discoverable, and exciting, I think. So I think that serves you up quite well.
Your point, I mean, I think that the when people ask me about, how they for their company should think about purpose, that the word that automatically comes to mind is authentic. It has to be authentic. If it's not, the particularly the young talent will see right through it, for the reasons you describe. And so, ours is very authentic. It is what we do, and it's why we do it. And I think for companies who struggle to sort of find that authenticity, it's much harder.
Agreed. And I think it all comes down to one word for you and for me, which is truth, right? Like
Right.
journalism and what you tell, what you report is based on truth. It's not negotiated, right? Truth is truth. It's
Exactly.
evident. I'm mindful of the time. I just want to ask you, Steve Hasker, one last question about sort of pearls of wisdom, any advice. You've given some great ones around, purpose and the like, but particularly for our younger people starting out, but maybe also for some older people who are perhaps jaded or disrupted or trying to pivot in their own careers. What sort of pearls of wisdom have you gleaned in your own career?
Well, people occasionally ask me, sort of what is or what has been your career goal and how much of a career plan have you had? And the truth is that I never really had a rock solid career plan. I envy those who do, by the way, particularly younger people who can say, you know, I want your job, Steve, or I want this job, or here's what I want to end up being my legacy or impact. I never really had that. So I adopted fairly early on a simple idea, which was I would always be attracted to and take advantage of, if I could, an opportunity which gave me a chance to learn. You know, if at those points in my career where I was offered a different get involved in a different project or a different role, I would ask a simple question, which is, do I think I'm going to learn more in that role and in that situation that I'm currently learning? And if the answer was yes, then I would take it. And that was my single sort of guiding principle. And it's held me in good stead. I'm not saying it's the only one, but it's certainly been one that I've stayed true to and I think has been very helpful. And as we think about an environment where generative AI is going to transform many things, many professions, I think that sort of orientation toward learning and open-mindedness, it's the best I can come up with. You know, I think it's the best way for each of us to navigate at this changing environment. I think if we have a less open-minded attitude toward it, it will be problematic.
I agree. I think I tell people all the time, work your technology, don't let it work you. So I'm actually very happy now teaching a ChatGPT course for working moms. I'm in my third week, and it's so fun helping these moms find the opportunities and the efficiencies that can come with ChatGPT. But then I also learn a lot as well. So it's that lifelong learning I think you described. One last question about that, though. I believe in our lifetime, the tenure has shrunken for how long one spends at one brand. It varies for each individual, but is there a suggestion you have about, like, yes, look for opportunities to grow and learn, but still make sure you put in like 1 year, 2 years, or
it's a great question. I think the onus is on the company to provide the career trajectory and the career development and the variety to encourage people to stay. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think companies that don't do that will see, you know, very high attrition and turnover and sort of churn through the younger talent. And those that provide that will have people stick with them. And that's certainly something we're very focused on.
Yeah, agreed. I would also add to that, I always say, you know, you also have to put your hand up, right? Sometimes, right, for whatever reason, your manager's not able to do that. And also because I've managed many people, as you have, you've done many more, but I always manage people for not just the moment in time. I think about the long-term trajectory. Right. And so I love that, because those people stay in your life even long after you've taken divergent career paths. So Steve Hasker, thank you so much. The President and Chief Executive Officer and Director at Thomson Reuters. So glad to have you on The Caring Economy. I want to have you back next year and let's talk about ChatGPT and all of that.
Great. Thanks, Toby.
Thank you for listening to The Caring Economy with Toby Usnick. Please share your comments and questions with Toby via Twitter at @TUsnick or LinkedIn at Toby Usnick. And thank you for sharing The Caring Economy with your friends and colleagues.